Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, darling. How are you today? Gotta get started with a nice word for the lady who talks so nice about us. Blog Talk Radio. Okay, good morning, everyone. This is Jeffrey Swartz, and I am a professor of law at WMU Cooley Law School, Tampa Bay campus, and I'm here together with my compatriot. What's your name again? Oh, yeah, Brendan Berry, who is also a professor of law at WMU Cooley Law School's Tampa Bay campus. And I'm supposed to tell all of you that what Brendan and I say on this show are our opinions and our opinions alone. They are not necessarily the opinions of the administration of WMU Cooley Law School, its faculty, either as individuals or at large. And happy Election Day, Brendan.
Yeah, we'll see about that.
Yeah, that's what I was going to hear from you. Okay, yeah. I got it. It is Election Day, and we are going to spend the day talking about a number of things related to the election. But I figured today I got to start out with something light. It's a very short story. It just happened maybe about 20 minutes ago. I was having my morning conversation with Marilyn on the phone, and we talked to each other video. And I got ready to hang up so I could get online here. And she says, take your hat off. And I'm wearing a baseball cap because I go for a workout in the morning, and then I come back, and there's no time for me to get. And besides, you guys can't see me anyway. What do you care? And I said, nobody cares. Nobody can see me. She says, yeah, you got to take your hat off because, you know, if you wear a hat, your brain's going to overheat. Okay? Okay. And it's going to affect you on the radio. And the only reason why I wear this hat is because I can't stand looking at myself in a mirror with my hair. I'm bald on the top, for those of you who don't know. And my hair sticks out like Bozo the Clown. Okay, so I can't stand that. And I put a hat on to bury my hair, what hair I have underneath it. But she sits there and tells me my brain's going to overheat. Okay?
Okay. You don't need a hat for that.
I don't need a hat for that. I overheated already. It doesn't really matter. So I've got to start out with something a little funny. Good morning, Marilyn. I know you're listening. She's sitting up on her deck listening to us on her computer. So let's all say good morning to Marilyn.
Hi, Marilyn. How are you doing?
Yeah. There you go. Okay. Trying to figure out what to talk about to start out the day. And there is just so much going on. And I thought I was going to start out with something that's strictly for the state of Florida, but I just changed my mind. It still is. And it really applies to everyone in the country, although it is in the state of Florida. And that is the most recent ad put on television by the Second Coming, Ron DeSantis, okay? And I say this not facetiously. He truly believes he is the Second Coming. He actually did an ad advertising he is the Second Coming. Okay? He basically said that God created the world in 6 days. He rested on the seventh day. And on the eighth day, he created Ron DeSantis. He needed one more day to complete his creation. This is what the ad says. God sent Ron DeSantis to save America. In this new video ad, his wife, Casey, says the narrator tells us that on day eight, God looked down on his planned paradise and said, I need a protector. So God made a fighter. This comes from his wife, Casey. That fighter is according to her, is Ron DeSantis, the governor who will serve the people and, quote, save their jobs, their livelihoods, their liberty, which he has no interest in saving, by the way, and their happiness. He actually put this on the air. And the bottom line is, he's not kidding. He honestly believes that as a Christian, I believe that he believes that Christ came and is the Son of God, but I am an original creation of God. Now, I don't know what Christians are buying this, and I don't know why Christians aren't appalled by this. If you believe in Genesis, which, by the way, is in our book, when I say our, it's in the Jewish Bible, you know, the Torah, okay? That's where Genesis comes from. If you're Jewish and you believe in Genesis, you have to be absolutely outraged that Moses would ignore Ron DeSantis and fail to be Nostradamus and predict that another Savior is going to – we're going to get one Savior, but we're going to get a second chance at one. How appalled do people have to be that anybody would call himself a specific creation of God? Who's coming to save the Christian world. And yet, people laugh at it, but it's not funny. That's a messianic complex. There's been a lot of those. None of them have survived, but they are all fascists. He has a messianic complex. He believes he's been brought not to just save Florida. He's here to save the country and the world. There's an old expression doctors learn. Physician, heal thyself. I think when you win tonight, and you are going to win tonight, Ron, you should go out there and say, hey, wait a minute. That was a joke. I apologize to every Jew and every Christian who believe in the Old Testament. I'm sorry. I apologize. I know my wife loves me. She goes overboard sometimes because she thinks that I walk on water. And there's only one guy who's been able to do that we know of, okay, or at least people believe existed, okay? And I can't do that. And why do I say that he's not here to save democracy, to save Christian democracy in this country? Is because his administration proposed and got the legislature to pass a proposed constitutional amendment in the state of Florida that is on the ballot today to do away with the Constitutional Revision Commission that sits every 20 years in this state and listens to the people. And then from all of the proposals that they receive, they pick maybe five or six that merit the attention of the voters and put those on the ballot for the people to vote on. How more democratic can you get? And yet he wants to abolish it. That's as undemocratic as you get. He's not here to save anything at all. He's here to take power. And that's why the other autocrat, Donald J., and he are not seeing eye to eye because they both want to be the Fuhrer. And the sad part is that Ron's going to ring up a big win today. He's going to be the first Republican to carry Miami-Dade County in my memory. And he is going to feel that is his mandate to become the savior of the country and run for president. And as Michael Steele put it today, because of all of that, Donald J. Trump today is sitting on his golden toilet, banging his head against the wall next to him, which is why he's declaring on the 15th his candidacy for presidency. And we'll talk about that some more and the effect of that. Okay, but he's going to announce on the 15th. He said it yesterday in Ohio. When he was supposed to be talking about J.D. Vance, he spent the whole time talking about himself, as usual. So, you know, get used to the idea that the Savior is not 6 feet tall with long blonde hair and perfectly white. He's short. He's dumpy. He's got dark hair that's cut in a haircut that I recognize from pictures of the 30s, okay, and walks around telling everybody what to do. And that's what I think today.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Brendan. Well, do your thing.
You better watch out. Chris Eliza might come after you for talking
about
those comparisons.
Yeah, go after him. I like that.
So I'm not happy with Chris Eliza this morning because we we spend a lot of time drawing historical comparisons between what's happening in the United States and again, you just mentioned it, and what happened in Germany in the 1930s. as you and I discussed earlier today, I mean, you can make those comparisons without using the words Nazi or Hitler. I mean, not, you know, I'm not saying that the people always avoid those words when making the comparisons, but and just in terms of the trend. So Jim Clyburn, the congressman, who is a student of history, as he himself has pointed out, is trying to ring the alarm bells right now. And he's now done it twice very recently. Historical developments, or the recent developments, rather, in the United States are troublingly similar and parallel to developments in, he's actually named two countries, Germany and Italy, in the 1930s. This drew a rebuke from Chris Eliza, who insists that we are not allowed. And by the way, I'm going to repeat here, Jim Clyburn didn't say Donald Trump is Hitler, and he didn't even use the word Nazi in discussing in very general terms the parallels historically between what's happening here and what happened there. But according to Chris Eliza, the golden rule of politics is that you may not ever, under any circumstances, draw any comparisons between current events and what happened in Germany in the 1930s. He considers, whether you use the words or not, he considers those to be comparisons to Hitler and Nazism, and it's an insult to say that anything like that is going on here. It's not an insult. I have done a little digging around. When one enters the Holocaust Museum, one can see a document posted, and here's what it says. The heading is Early Warning Signs of Fascism, and there are 12 items enumerated under that heading. One, powerful and continuing nationalism. Okay. Fascism relies on nationalism and tribalism. Keep America great, make America great again, America first, all sounds familiar, huh? Disdain for human rights is the second early warning sign. People who don't care about due process, they don't care about protecting people from violence, right? So disdain for human rights. You know, Donald Trump bragging that waterboarding is nothing compared to what he's going to do. Next, identification of enemies as a unifying cause. Boy, have we been talking about that, the other, right? Whether it's Jewish people or gay people or black people or Hispanic people or people coming from other parts of the world, right? That's always somebody with these people, fascists, that is. Supremacy of the military, right? Military right, obsession with all things military. That actually started on the American political right quite some time ago, well before Trump. Rampant sexism is another one on the list of early warning signs of fascism. Anybody who knows anything about Donald Trump or Trumpism or anybody who's been watching the right-wing project to dismantle women's rights. That's everywhere. Controlled mass media. Truth Social much. Right, this effort to call everything that doesn't reflect the right-wing propaganda machine as fake news, and Elon Musk now joins the ranks of Rupert Murdoch in trying to consolidate that. Obsession with national security. Here's one, Jeff, religion and government intertwined, right? One of the early warning signs of fascism, right? That we lose our ability to distinguish between what is religion and what is politics. You just described that to a T. Corporate power protected, labor power suppressed, disdain for intellectuals and the arts, right? That's we just recently talked about this in another context. Anybody wants to see disdain for elites, right, and the arts, read some of the Antonin Scalia's dissents in some Supreme Court cases. That'll give you a good primer on how these people think about academia and the arts. Obsession with crime and punishment. I don't think I've seen a single Republican ad that was not obsessed with crime and punishment. Rampant cronyism and corruption. We see it everywhere, especially in the Trump White House. And fraudulent elections. How about that? I bring you January 6th and the greatest attempt at election theft in American history. And I suppose, I think there's two things left off this list. It's a pretty good list, though. One is projection, right? Basically, fascists will accuse their opponents of being all of these things. and the other is political violence, right? As a valid tool for conducting political life. We see those as well.
One of the things you just mentioned, isn't that the key to the success of fascism? To always accuse the other of doing something that you mm-hmm. either are or are going to do yourself,
mm-hmm.
which right. you then justify what you're doing based upon what the other person is going to or is doing.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And isn't that what we've seen continuously? I mean, I think that's one of the great things about not the great things, but one of the great things that shows out about fascism is that's exactly how you convince people how right you are. Predict something you're going to do yourself and blame the other people for doing it first.
Right. Right. That's and we have got to get out of this Chris Saliza world where I can't read that. Right? I can't read this document without being accused of breaking the golden rule of politics. So never compare what's happening now to what's happened in Germany in the 1930s. Well, then how are we going to avoid it if we don't even see it? So that's what I really think this morning. I am outraged by this mindless, it's like Chris Saliza was just looking for some reason to take a jab at Congressman Clyburn. I mean, I'm going to say it again. The congressman didn't even say that these are American Nazis or that Trump or DeSantis is Hitler. He didn't say that. He said the history is parallel and we have to watch it. And he's right.
Yeah, there literally is no question, okay, that calling it out for what it is important. It may offend people, but even let's look at it from this point of view. If you say something and you say that something is fascist or fascism, if the person who's angry at what you're saying wants to prove you wrong, all they're going to do is do the research to prove that you're right. But sometimes you have to say something people don't want to hear. And I can give you an example of that that happened to me yesterday. I teach a class at the Osher Lifelong Learning Institute that basically they're senior citizens who are mostly retired who want to take classes and learn something new. And I've taught there a number of times. In fact, I have the class I taught yesterday, all but about two or three of the people in that room had taken classes from me in the past, and they come back. And there was a new person there who clearly was not what I would refer to as a senior citizen. She clearly was younger than everybody else in the room. And I was talking about what was happening in the United States and why we see some of the things that we're seeing. And as I was talking, it got around to basically saying that much of what we see from the far right, those who call themselves conservatives, those who call themselves originalists, whatever you want to call them, okay, what you see from them is their fear. And that is that in the next 10 years, it is a demographic reality that we all have to face up to, whether you like it or you don't like it, that this country will be a minority-majority country. In other words, white people will no longer be the majority of the people who live in this country. And I said, what those people are operating on, I'm quoting myself, I've said this on this program, and what they are thinking is they are out to protect their white privilege, their belief that white people, quote, founded this country, without thinking about the Native Americans, the millions and millions of Native Americans who lived in this country before we wiped them all out, okay, and that they are here almost like the DeSantis thought process, that they were anointed by God, okay, and that they're in fear of their white privilege disappearing. This woman didn't take 30 seconds to pack up all of her stuff and walk out the door, and made a demonstration of it as she walked out. And all I did was turn to the people that were in the room and say, I must have said something she didn't like. And, of course, I got a lot of laughter. But the truth is, I hope she goes home to train and comes back next week to class trying to prove me wrong. Because in the process of proving me wrong, she's going to find out that I'm right. And that will be more disturbing than anything else to her. But it will be an education. And so this is no different than Saliza. It almost appears, although we can see his eyes in the picture on CNN, because I was looking at the posting of the story, he's wearing his glasses like he always does. They seem to have a tint to them. Obviously, I think he has transition lenses, and although it's like a one-way mirror, we can see in, but he can't see out.
Mm-hmm.
He needs to take his blinders off. He has to start thinking like most thinking journalists do, in recognizing that, yes, this is what we are dealing with. We are dealing with people who are fascists, who want to do away with our liberties, want to do and tell us how to live our lives and how we teach our children and how we raise our children, because telling us how to raise our children the way they want us to raise them raises a whole generation of fascists to follow the Führer. That's why it took a decade to denazify Germany. And that's what they want to do. So he's wrong. He's utterly and completely wrong. If you're a journalist, you call something out for what it is. Not because you're afraid you're going to offend people. This is not the third rail of politics, Elizabeth. There's other things that are third rails. This is not a third rail of politics. Never use the word Nazi. First of all, the word Nazi wasn't used. But if you want to equate fascism to Nazis, yeah, you can, but there was Italy, and there's been Brazil, and there's been the Philippines, And there's been Japan before World War II. There's fascism all over the world, but not here. At least not, I hope, ever exists here. So you're right about Cilicia. While you were talking, I was reading the story. Be that as it may.
Yeah. Yeah.
Speaking of fascists, might as well talk about a few of them. Donald was in Ohio last night. Supposedly, he was there to help J.D. Vance beat Tim Ryan. But all he talked about was himself. Is anybody here surprised?
Yeah, shocking.
Yeah, it is shocking that someone would do something like that. I mean, I just, you know. And you don't even have to go to the damn rallies. You know what you're going to hear. Why don't you just take an old rally, play it on tape? That's what you're going to see, including the red hat. But while he was there, he announced that he has an announcement. We're going to do it next Tuesday or Wednesday, whatever the 15th is. Tuesday, I guess Tuesday. We got a big announcement. You know, the way he talks. We got a big announcement at Mar-a-Lago. On the 15th, and he had music playing in the background as he was saying this. You have to see this, music in the background, soft music, mood music. And that I don't know if he even introduced J.D. Vance. I don't know if he ever said a word about him. Usually on these things, you know, for example, if it's Obama, he goes up there and he gives a speech. And then he lets people like Josh Shapiro follow up in Pennsylvania. By the way, did anybody see the speech that Josh Shapiro gave? Either of you hear it?
No, I heard
you did?
Summit. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, but you have to see it. You have to see him speak. You have to see the power of what he was saying with the power of his voice. It was phenomenal. It really was an incredibly powerful speech. And you know, I won't even try to paraphrase it. I will just tell you that he painted a picture of Democrats for democracy, Republicans for fascism. Democrats who want to do something and Republicans who want to take things away from you. It was a phenomenal speech. And it rang, you know, after following Obama and coming up there, and Obama warms up this crowd, he just finished it. It was amazing to listen to him. But normally, you know, Obama will come, Biden will come, and they will introduce the candidate that they're there to support so that the candidate gets the last word. Not Donald. Donald's the closer. And you have to remember that J.D. Vance is going to let him do that because J.D. Vance, in the words of Donald Trump, not mine, kisses his ass. He has embarrassed J.D. Vance every time they've been around each other. He just embarrasses the hell out of him, diminishes him. And if Ohioans want that, then that's what they're going to get. But I don't think they want that. I think Tim Ryan's going to win tonight. I really do. It's close. I think Tim Ryan's going to pull it out. And we'll know that. You know, there's bellwether congressional seats. Nancy Kaptur's seat in the 9th Ohio District, which, by the way, was a district that 45 years ago I wanted to stay in Toledo and run for. And she's been there 30 years, so, you know, as long as I don't screw up, that could have been me. But Nancy Kaffer's up. And the bigger she wins, the better the shot that Tim Ryan has to win. Pay attention to Cleveland. Did they turn out to vote? Not necessarily the suburbs, but the not the eastern suburbs, but the western suburbs, like Mayfield Heights and Shaker Heights and those places. And then take a look at the urban vote in Cincinnati. Columbus is kind of a lost cause. That's going to be a Republican. If he carries Columbus, Franklin County, then he's a winner, for sure. So watch those, but I think Tim Ryan's going to win. I think Oz is going to lose. I think Fetterman's going to win that seat. Yep, I think Fetterman's going to win. Oz has made a couple of really drastic mistakes in the last few days, not remembering the schedule for the Pittsburgh Steelers or the Philadelphia Eagles and talking about people sitting at home watching the Steelers this past weekend, and people had to remind them the Steelers have a bye this week, moron. And then he went full MAGA the other night when Donald was in town. So I think that Fetterman pulls that out. It's going to be close, but I think Fetterman ends up winning. And I think it's because of Shapiro. I don't think people are going to split their ticket between Shapiro and Oz. If they're voting for Shapiro, I think they're going to go down the ticket and vote for Fetterman. So, if Donald loses those two seats that are his big endorsements, he better rethink what he's going to do on the 15th. But that's a signal he is not going to carry Pennsylvania and he's not going to carry Ohio. And when Gretchen Whitmer wins in Michigan, he's not going to carry Michigan. And I'm going to keep my eye on Wisconsin. I think Wisconsinites are stupid enough to reelect Ron Johnson, but one can hope maybe they have a lucid moment. I'm not counting on that one. But, you know, Donald has to know he's not going to win the presidency without Pennsylvania, Ohio, and Michigan. And they're sending him a message because he campaigned for Tudor Dixon. Now, Whitmer is ahead a little bit outside of the margin of error. But I think the constitutional amendment to legalize abortion under the Roe guidelines is going to carry her back in. And Tudor Dixon is telling people to, she tried to soften it up and say, you can vote for me and vote for the amendment too. So split your ticket. I want to do away with abortion, but you can vote to legalize it. We'll just find a way around it later. That happened, I think, on Wednesday night or Thursday, something like that. So I think she realizes that they're coming out to vote on the abortion issue in Michigan, and that doesn't bode well for Republicans in Michigan. So I think, you know, there's going to be some bad news. I think there's no way that Democrats hold the House. There's just no way. It just isn't going to happen. But I think that they can hold the Senate and probably maybe even expand in the Senate, which basically makes – I can't use the expression that most guys would use to describe Republicans if all they can do is try to create problems and come up with no solutions and pass stuff that they know won't make it through the Senate and won't make it past President Biden. Just so that they can try to create issues for 24. But if Democrats hold the Senate, that basically makes them toothless. They can try to create problems, but they're not going to get very far with it. I think they're going to pick up 20, 25 seats. They're going to have a strong majority. It's not going to be a narrow majority. It's going to be a pretty strong majority, I think. So that's kind of the way
I see it. Remarkable. Just remarkable.
No.
I mean, you just keep asking yourself, you know, how low can this party go before Americans are done with the Republican Party? Just done. And I am the last person you want to ask that question because I'm wrong every time. If you showed me what was going on January 6th, I would have told you this is it. This is the end for Trump. This is the end for the Republican Party. They cannot survive this. And I was wrong. I was wrong. Yeah. Americans, you know, I guess the cost of a gallon of milk is more important.
Well, surprisingly, trying to remember who it was. I've got it up here. Let me pull it up right now. Gallup came out with a poll based upon the end of October. And although it's risen to 46%, the most important problem facing the country today was not, quote, inflation, because that's down around 20%. It's 46% for all of the economic problems that we see. Taxes are a problem for them. Wage issues are a problem for them. All Americans. The federal budget got like 2%. Cost of living and inflation was 20% of the total of 46% of the people said economic problems are the most important thing.
Mm-hmm.
But surprisingly, non-economic problems was at 61%. Although it fell from its high of 70 a few months ago, it's still 61%. A majority of these people find that government and poor leadership is 14%. Immigration is 8%. Unifying the country is 4%. Crime and violence is only at 4%. Election reform, democracy was 4%, which I tie to being government and poor leadership. I put those two together. Abortion, 3%. I mean, that was top, the percentage of people who thought things were. So there are major, 61% of voters think there's non-economic issues that are more important than the economy, which means when they go into the polling place, things are going to start percolating in the back of their mind. And they're going to look at some of this stuff, that these things that they're looking at, they're going to look at the people they're voting for, and they're going to say, just like they did in 2020, Trump people who went in to vote and switched and voted for Biden, I just can't do this. I can't. And all of a sudden, the pen moves itself across the ballot and marks for someone else. And I think that was a very important factor in 2020, that people who leaned towards Trump or voted for him in 2016 went in there and said, no, I can't do it anymore. I can't deal with this guy anymore. I can't deal with the things that he's doing anymore. I need sanity. And one can only hope that that's what will happen in Arizona. But I thought that was interesting when I saw that this morning. I think it's very telling. Now, some of these things may not overcome the vote that they're ready to make. But if it happens, that's a sign that there'll be a break. But I still don't think that's going to save the House. The gerrymandering that's been done, it's already baked in. There are very few really competitive races. We'll talk about a few of them in a minute. But, you know, one can only hope that the voters of Arizona will do that. Because Carrie Lake wants to be Vice President of the United States.
Mm-hmm.
Carrie Lake went beyond full MAGA this week. She went QAnon this week. She was seen with one of the leading figures in the QAnon movement. campaigning with that person. She was campaigning with Steve Bannon this week. She has already declared that if she doesn't win, there's fraud in the election. She has said if by 11 o'clock, at 11 o'clock, no matter what the results are at 11 o'clock, the clock is run, you stop counting. Why? Because they don't start even looking at the mail-in ballots till 7 o'clock when the polls close. And they all have to be verified before they're run and counted, which is why it took so long in Arizona in 2020. And they've done nothing to make it better. They were offered money from the federal government to hire more people to start scanning and counting absentee ballots and early voting. So at 7 o'clock, like in Florida, at 7 o'clock, those ballots and that count just, at 7:15, it just drops. It's already counted. It's already in there. They're required at 7:15 to drop those votes into the totals. They release that count. And that's the way to do it. But they're not doing it that way in Georgia, and they're not doing it that way in Arizona. And she has said, at 11 o'clock, we just stopped counting. It's over. And so she's already started with that. And sending her people out to the polls going, stop the count, stop the count. Only we count. Only we who voted on Election Day count. That's kind of fascist, wouldn't you think?
Yeah, no kidding.
I'm winning, so we don't have to count anymore. I voted for myself, therefore I win. So that's what, and that's Carrie Lake. And she may carry this guy Masters into the Secretary of State's job. And she may be able to defeat Kelly for the Senate seat.
Mm-hmm.
I said, "Wait, Masters running for the Senate, or is he running for Secretary of State? I can't remember which." An election denier who was in Washington, sort of like Mastriano in Pennsylvania. Greatest thing that happened to Democrats in Pennsylvania since Benjamin Franklin. It's going to be interesting tonight. And we're going to have 61 districts in the country are going to be monitored by the Department of Justice. And they're going to be all over Arizona. They're going to be all over Pennsylvania. They're going to be all over Texas. And Alabama. I don't think they need to come to Florida. I don't think it would make a difference. So,
well, the state is trending in one direction and one direction alone.
Yeah. No. I mean, we've gone from slightly purple to just ruby red.
Yeah.
And I don't understand that. I'm going to tell you why I don't understand that. What senior citizen?
Mm-hmm.
What kind of moron are senior citizens who vote for Republicans? If for only one reason, they want to end your Social Security. Don't you understand that? The junior senator, Rick Scott, he looks like Voldemort, has made it clear that it is the Republican policy to make Social Security renewable, like every year. We'll decide whether you get it anymore or not every year. He wants to cut Medicare benefits. He wants to cut Social Security. To him, these are entitlements. I'm sorry, you're right. I am entitled to Social Security because I frigging paid for it.
Mm-hmm.
I started working at 13. Paying into Social Security. So don't tell me that I'm wrong for feeling entitled. I am entitled because it's my frigging money. And yet, down at the villages,
State Parade for Donald Trump and Rick Scott and Marco Rubio, people who want to take the money out of their pockets and take the medical care out of their lives. I don't understand. Third base. I literally cannot understand senior citizens. I mean, how there is a fining of senior citizens for Donald Trump because he's going to take us back to the 1950s? We're going to pull out all the old Ozzie and Harriet shows and the Dick Van Dyke shows where men and women slept in separate beds? By the way, just as an aside, just a little piece of trivia, do you know what television show was the first show to show a man and a woman sleeping in a king-size bed together? Theory? Mm-hmm. Do you know?
No.
It was the Bob Newhart show.
Uh-huh. Mm. Scandalous.
Yeah. The last scene of the last show of Bob Newhart's second series, without Suzanne Pleshette, the ending was that he woke up in bed with Suzanne Pleshette saying, "You wouldn't believe the dream I just had." Okay, making fun of Dallas. That's the first time a television series, had a man and a woman sleeping in the same bed.
Mm-hmm.
But this is where they want to go back to. We're going to dig up Lucy and Desi and have them redo the show. I mean, Roberts, the televangelist. Oral Roberts. No, that's Pat Robertson. Oral Roberts.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
The faith healer. Right. I used to watch him when I was a kid on Sunday morning, faith healing. He put his hands on people and they'd walk or they'd see.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to bring back Oral Roberts. This is what they want. They've been trying to destroy Social Security for 90 years. By the way, that's how long Social Security has been around. Okay.
Right.
Okay, that's been Republicans' goal since the New Deal. It's like dogma for them. So I don't understand that. I don't understand how senior citizens can in any way, shape, or form find anything good about Republicans. But, hey, you know, I'm not welcome at the Villages. Could you just see me at the Villages with all my Democratic signs on my front lawn?
Oh, God.
Riding around in a one-cart parade, okay, supporting Democratic citizens. Okay. Okay, here I am, everybody. The parade. Parade just ended. Okay. Let's see. I made a note here about Georgia, and I think Georgia's worth talking about. I don't know. Maybe you disagree. You know what? I'll skip that. Because I can't talk about Herschel Walker anymore. I just can't. I mean, it makes me want to. It puts me off my breakfast, and I haven't had breakfast yet. Okay, so I want to be able to eat when the show is over.
Okay. That's another one. Well, how are these races even close? I mean, it is. Well, you were just talking about elderly people, and I was trying to think as you were talking. Yeah, what is it? They're clearly voting against their own interests. I mean, it's so obvious.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah.
But they don't see it that way.
You know, and I'm wondering why, and I'm thinking, you know, if you're a voter who's angry and aggrieved, I think all of these rational issues just go out the window.
Yes, that's true.
And so these are just angry people who mm-hmm. are terribly aggrieved and looking for somebody to blame. And they're just going to vote for the person who's angry with them and who's aggrieved, the grievance party. You know, it's amazing
yeah.
what emotional thinking does to the rational mind.
And that's why, in particular, Republicans continue to harp on emotional issues.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, yeah, a grievance, things that make people angry. They're living on people's anger.
Yeah.
Not realizing that if they don't solve the problem that's making voters angry, that anger will turn on them. It eventually will turn on them. And they just don't realize that. And they should have realized it in 2018. They should have realized it in that election in 2016. Or actually 18, when Democrats took the House. And in 20, when Democrats kept the House. They should have realized that, but they don't. For whatever the reason are, whatever the reason may be, the Republican Party is scared to death of one man who, if they all ganged up on him, could do nothing about it. And they just don't realize that. I wanted to talk over the last few minutes of give people an idea of what to look for tonight. I'm going to start with the Michigan 7th congressional seat. This is the one where the incumbent, Congresswoman Slotkin, who sat on the January 6th committee, has had a redrawing of her district, which makes it very purple and very competitive. She's getting help from Liz Cheney, and that is a bellwether for the state, I think, nationally, and maybe even for the state, not so much for the state of Michigan, but for statewide races, but it's interesting. The Alaska at large district is important, although we won't know anything about it before we all go to bed. They have what's known as ranked choices, preferential rank, voting, and it could be very interesting to watch. This is the one where Sarah Palin lost the special election a few months ago, and it's anticipated that the Democrat who won that seat, a guy by the name of Nick Begich, probably will hold on to the seat. It'll be interesting to see what happens there. The Arizona 2nd, a Democratic representative by the name of Tom O'Halloran, is facing a very difficult race after the legislature redrew the lines of his district, and which covers most of the eastern half of the state and included a lot more Republican voters. It'll be interesting to see his opponent, Eli Crane, who is a former Navy SEAL, and he called on the legislature to decertify Biden's win in 2020. I'm not sure that that's going to do a whole lot of good, but that's also Carrie Lake's thing. She wants to decertify the election. I don't think he can, but nice try anyway. The California 22nd includes a Democratic representative who voted for impeachment. They redrafted some of those lines, and it's going to be a difficult seat. The Kansas 3rd is interesting. A Democratic incumbent in there caught in a redrawing of the lines, which made it more purple. So it'll be interesting after the vote by Kansas on the referendum involving abortion to see what happens in the Kansas 3rd. I've already talked to you about the Ohio 9th, the Oregon 5th. Here the Democrat beat an incumbent Democrat in the primary, and that Democratic candidate clearly may be too liberal for the overall electorate in Oregon, which tends to get very conservative once you get outside of Portland. The Virginia 2nd, what? I heard something. I heard a beep. Okay, maybe it was somebody's phone. The Virginia 2nd Luria, who a Congresswoman Luria, who sat on the 1-6 committee, is running there. It's a mostly military district she's in. It'll be interesting to see the effect that the military has on that. Let's see. Did I already talk about the Arizona second? I don't think I did. Yeah, I did. I talked about the Arizona second. The Florida 13th, a redesigned district. There is a Republican by the last name of Luna, and she is a lunatic. She says she is a radical, right-wing person. She says she's radically right-wing when it comes to abortion. She's radical right when it comes to government. She is a Trumpite to the nth degree, argues that the election was stolen, and she's up against a former congressional aide who spent about 20 years working for Democratic congressmen by the last name of Lynn. And I think that he is probably going to pull this one out, but it's interesting to see by how much. Whether voters in the western part of Florida, who generally might vote Republican, whether they're fed up or not. And the last one's the Maine second. There are two independents running against each other, which kind of affects the way people vote. They have ranked voting there, too. And these two independents are, and Maine loves their independents, more likely than not will end up in the runoff. There probably won't be a clear winner there. All of these things, and one more, the Michigan 3rd, which was Congressman Myers' old seat, he voted for impeachment. He was challenged by a very pro-Trump, very far right-wing, so-called Republican. Democrats poured money in trying to help that so-called Republican, and they succeeded in unseating Mr. Meyer, Congressman Meyer. And it appears that that strategy, at least as to the Michigan 3rd, is going to work. And a Democrat, that'll be a Democratic pickup in the Grand Rapids area. So these are things to look for. As far as governors, take a look at how big Governor Hochul in New York will win, how big Josh Shapiro's win may be. He's up by almost 20 points right now in polls. It could be far worse than that for Mastriano. And look at the Senate seat there. Take a look at the Senate seat in Ohio. Take a look at Ron Johnson in Wisconsin. And I'll obviously take a look at what happens down in Georgia. Those are the Senate seats of great import that you should all be looking for tonight. And I'll be looking at them. I'll be doing some television work tonight. So I'm going to be watching those. And that will give us a pretty good idea what's going on. So I just wanted to add all of that. I wanted to get into it before we ran out of time, which we just did.
Well done.
I got things going across my phone, and now I realize why. Okay. Yeah. I'll let you have the last word, Brendan.
All right. Well, we'll keep an eye on what happens tonight. It's going to be a very important night for the future of democracy or not. And I'll say this as well. If anything happens to Steve Kornacki, MSNBC should just pick you up. Sounds like you you pulled a pretty good Steve Kornacki on me here. That was good. Nice little summation. Yeah.
I'm sorry. I don't like khaki State Press pants.
Okay.
So I can't be Steve Kornacki. Okay.
Sorry.
And as thin as I've gotten, okay, I'm not as thin as Steve Kornacki.
Okay.
This guy.
And you don't gesticulate enough either. Yeah.
And that's true. Okay. And meanwhile, yeah. I can't do predictions for football. Okay. And that's what he's doing now every Sunday. So. I'm sorry. I'm sorry. He's getting a little full of himself. Okay. I do wear button-down shirts, so. Okay. So.
Yep.
But I appreciate
confirm
the
that.
Comparison.
Yep.
That's a real compliment. I appreciate that. Thank you.
Hey,
okay.
You're welcome.
Hezzy, we're going to say goodbye to you now, if you're there. I guess Hezzy's not there. Okay. And that's fine. He's got things to do. Okay.
Yep.
I will see. I'll be seeing you at noon. Is it noon or 1 o'clock? It's usually 1 o'clock.
You
but
mean for our pre?
Whatever time it is.
Yeah, I'll see you then.
For our pre-class. Yeah, for those who are listening, Brendan and I teach a seminar with two other professors every Tuesday at 3 o'clock. And being that we all procrastinate as much as we do, we meet at the end of the week and kind of figure things out and then solidify it maybe an hour before class. So we've got a meeting. I'm pretty sure it's at 1 o'clock. I'm almost positive
it's at 1 or 2. Yeah.
According to what I'm seeing, actually.
Oh, good.
I'm not even seeing any of it, but I know we're going to meet.
No,
but,
yeah.
I'm pretty sure it's 1 o'clock, but I'll contact you know who and make sure something goes.
Yep.
On. Okay.
Yep. Sounds
okay,
good.
Man.
All right.
You have a good one. I'll see you sometime. Okay.
All right. Bye, everybody.
Okay. Goodbye.
Yep.
Goodbye, everybody.
Bye.
Sorry for the delay. We're doing a special selection, and we're going to look into where does anti-Semitism begin. So it's going to be really very interesting. This comes from Deutsche Welle, the German World, and I'll play this for you.
There was a compliment that I got. Oh, you're pretty for a Jew.
There are a lot more anti-Semitic incidents than you might think.
That's Anna, cancer researcher in Munich. And Dora, judge in Berlin. What most people only see when it hits the headlines, they've experienced in everyday life. Discrimination because they're Jews.
It's real, and it never went away.
It can be subtle. It can be in your face. Sometimes anti-Semitism can be hard to recognize, even in yourself. But no, don't run away. You don't necessarily have to have a malicious intention to say something anti-Semitic.
The murkiness behind anti-Semitism.
I describe myself as a liberal Jew.
Here we have a tradition-oriented community. There was one bad incident where someone drove by the synagogue on a motorbike and shouted Heil Hitler. This was during drop-off time for the kids at daycare, when a lot of parents bring their children.
And then at a party, someone said to me, did Hitler forget one or something?
Adolf Hitler was the dictator of Nazi Germany, responsible for the systematic murder of 6 million Jews.
As a Jew, what do you do in a situation like that? I was pretty stunned.
I was interviewed. It was supposed to be for a feature in a major German magazine. Afterward, we had a coffee and we were sitting together, and then out of nowhere came the question. But come on, let's be honest. With Jews, it's always about the money, right? And you just think, wait a minute, did I hear that right?
And that's just one trope that's been doing the rounds for centuries. In fact, anti-Semitic tropes are nothing new. They've been passed down and reappear in every era, repackaged and seemingly shiny and new for the next generation. Anti-Semitism comes in many different forms. Miriam Wenzel, director of Frankfurt Jewish Museum, Germany. So let's look at that example about wealth and money.
Historically, Jews were excluded from many professions in Europe. And among the jobs they were allowed to do was traditionally dealing with coins or exchanging money. That was the case in the early modern period, and this led to the idea that Jews have something to do with money.
Times of crisis provide particularly fertile ground for spreading anti-Semitic tropes and conspiracies, an age-old and murky myth, the hidden hand.
We can't see it. It's not there, but there is an assumption that there is something sinister.
Harry Dubnoff, history professor, George Washington University.
We saw it even in cases like the COVID pandemic, right? The questions of who exactly benefits from the COVID, and then implying that actually it's a conspiracy of Jewish, you know, businessmen and the companies that are producing the vaccines and so on.
It's a convenient idea that there's a small group of people secretly controlling the world. In reality, it's an ungrounded conspiracy theory that's really old. That, of course, is absolutely the core anti-Semitic narrative, and it's a Christian one. This hidden hand is a faceless anti-Semitic trope dating back as far as the Middle Ages, when Christianity strove to become the dominant religion in Europe and began to persecute Jews. And that means that the conspiracy theory that Jews are doing something in secret is always part of the mobilization of feelings, which in turn leads to acts of violence.
I often wonder what the Germans actually say over family Christmas dinner, for example, if anti-Semitic conspiracy theories come up at the table. Do you stay silent or do you speak up?
You should say something, because ignoring anti-Semitism won't make it magically go away. Let's stay in Germany for a while. So why does it seem like it's so difficult for a lot of Germans to confront anti-Semitism today? Maybe because they see it as something gone and overcome?
I think a lot of people associate anti-Semitism only with World War II, that Hitler created anti-Semitism and it was all over in 1940, and that's just completely ahistorical.
So that's another thing. Anti-Semitism isn't just a Nazi thing. But although Jews were long subjected to violence, expulsions, forced conversions, and systematic persecution, the Nazi era was undoubtedly without parallel. Starting in 1933, the Nazis used anti-Semitic legislation and propaganda to create a culture of segregation and hostility. All over Nazi-occupied Europe, Jews were eventually detained in ghettos and deported to concentration or death camps, where they were subjected to forced labor, atrocities, and mass murder. By the time Nazi Germany surrendered, 6 million Jews had been murdered.
The minute we automatically think that the step next after anti-Semitism is already Holocaust, we find it problematic to identify the more sinister, the more mundane, the discriminatory practices, the tropes, the trafficking of stereotypes that is not automatically tomorrow is leading, God forbid, for complete nihilism and genocidal practices.
So you're an anti-Semite only if you say Jews should go to the gas chamber? Anything else is legitimate criticism?
So don't be mistaken. The bar for anti-Semitism isn't set at murder. It can also sound like this.
Oh, you look pretty for a Jew.
But what does that do to a person?
You notice it when my grandmother gives me matzo crackers on Passover and I put them in the car and she says, no, never leave them lying around, hide them. I don't want my neighbor to see that we're Jewish. There are a lot of Jews in my circle of friends who aren't open about being Jewish because they've had bad experiences with anti-Semitism. It's just stressful for me to pretend 24/7, so I'm open about being Jewish. If someone has a problem with that, they should just come and sort it out with me.
I think there are many different reactions. This is quite distinct, even in the same person. There's the feeling of, I'll get my suitcase out. I have to be better prepared for what's happening. Can I really permanently belong to society here? Am I sufficiently protected? Where do I move to?
For some Jews, that one place they can feel safe is Israel, the world's only Jewish state. Since 1950, Jews from all over the world and Gentile converts to Judaism are entitled to settle in Israel and receive full Israeli citizenship if they want to.
For me as a practicing Jew, it's meaningful when I can celebrate Jewish holidays there.
And it's a safe haven. There's also the feeling that there's a country, that there's a place to simply be, and to maybe not have the feeling of being in a minority.
That's historically been of great importance to Jews. But walking down the street wearing my Star of David and knowing that nothing will happen is an incredible feeling as a Jew. But the decades since the founding of the State of Israel have seen a new facet of anti-Semitism emerge, Israel-related anti-Semitism. More often than not, political events linked to Israel also prompt a rise in anti-Semitic attacks, way beyond Israel's borders, especially when there's a flare-up in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict.
As soon as there's conflict in Israel, the atmosphere here immediately becomes tougher, more uncomfortable.
So what's always a bit irritating for me is when I say I'm Jewish and then people criticize me for Israel's policies or blame me for them. I don't have an Israeli passport. I can't vote there. I don't have the right to vote there. I don't have a say in the political situation, and I'm not Israeli. In fact, the vast majority of Jews around the world are not Israeli. Many have no connection with the country.
When someone asks me, what do you think about what's going on in Israel right now, and without an accusatory undertone, well, doing there again, but simply, what do you make of it, then of course I answer them normally, but it's not what you say, it's how you say it.
So, Jews all over the world are not responsible for Israeli policy. Of course, the Israeli government can be criticized. But where do you draw the line between anti-Semitism and political debate?
I would draw the line in several cases. Demonstrating not in front of the Israeli embassy, but in front of a synagogue, that's already starting to blur the line.
There you already see one of the central problems. In criticism of the Israeli government's policy, there's very often the connotation of questioning the right to exist.
Forcing Jews to, whether they we talk about Israel or not, automatically when they enter into the room, state your position regarding Israel. Are you pro or against? You have to state it very clearly up front. This is also, you know, if not borderline anti-Semitism, it's up front anti-Semitism. It automatically assumes that the every Jew per definition by them being Jewish are, in a way, agents of the Israeli government and so on and so forth.
So how to handle this political hot potato? Not talk about it at all?
That's why I'm a bit cautious about this idea that you mustn't talk about Israel at all. Of course, Israel is close to us, and of course, it means more to us than many other countries. Yes, you can just talk about it normally.
So, criticizing Israeli policy, fine. Conflating Israeli state policy and Jewish life, not fine, and often anti-Semitic. Today, anti-Semitism is even easier to spread, thanks to social media. Which means you should be extra cautious when it comes to where you're getting your information.
Like reading the fine print on any food that we put into our body, we need to be careful. The fact that it's simply out there and people are retweeting it or sharing it on Facebook doesn't guarantee anything in terms of its validity, often, unfortunately, the opposite.
So with that in mind, don't believe everything you read. The world over, Jews experience anti-Semitism, no matter when or where. And ultimately, it boils down to the same tropes, same prejudices, same hatred. Battling it is arduous. And yet, there's so much more to being Jewish, fighting this hatred.
That's
perhaps something I'd wish for, continuing to take a look at active Jewish life and showing what's actually happening. Because there's always a great danger on the Jewish side, too, that you only think within these dimensions of anti-Semitism and you actually forget the positive sides of it.
I can't identify with that victim role at all. I always wear my Star of David openly. I walk through the streets of Munich as a proud Jewish woman.
Well, very powerful, this description of what goes on. Yeah, but the tropes are definitely all over the place. If that's one of the problems. All right, well, we'll see. We have a little bit more time, so we'll be able to move on to a couple of other things. And bear with me a moment as we try to find out what else is going on here and hopefully catch up. This is very, very interesting. I don't understand all of this. World Cup ambassador evidently says that homosexuality is damage in the mind, quote unquote. So amid concerns about Qatar's approach towards LGBTQ fans, its World Cup ambassador has said homosexuality is, quote, damage in the mind, end quote, and, quote, spiritual harm, end quote. A press officer then cut off his interview. The days after Qatar's foreign minister said all people would be welcome to his country for the upcoming Men's World Cup, including members of the LGBTQ community, its World Cup ambassador has labeled homosexuality, quote, damage in the mind, end quote, as well as spiritual harm, quote, end quote, and ultimately haqam, quote, end quote, in the Muslim-majority emirate, meaning a sin. Well, Khalid Salman, a former national player for Qatar, and now the Emirates World Cup ambassador, said in a documentary to be broadcast on German public broadcaster ZDF on Tuesday, that's later on today, that he has problems with children seeing gay men and women because they then learn something they should not. Not a strict Muslim, he said, but why is it haram? It's spiritual haram, against sin. Excerpts from the documentary by German sports journalist and TV presenter Jochen Breyer titled Geheimsache Katar or Secret Affairs Qatar were pre-released by ZDF on its Monday news bulletin. In the release footage, the media officer of the Qatar World Cup Organizing Committee, who accompanied the ZDF team during its video recording, ended an interview just after Salman referred to homosexuality as, quote, damage in the mind, end quote. In another excerpt, Salman said, quote, during the World Cup, a lot of things will come into the country. Let's talk about gays, for example. Important thing is that everyone will accept that they come here, they will have to accept our rules. Homosexual acts in public are forbidden in Qatar and can be punished by up to 7 years in prison. The captain of several European countries competing in the World Cup, including Germany, France, and England, planned to wear armbands in rainbow colors during their matches as part of an anti-discrimination campaign. Well, Qatar has also come under criticism for its human rights record and its treatment of foreign workers. Fans in stadiums across Germany waved banners over the weekend calling for a boycott of the event, including television viewing. Well, German Interior Minister Nancy Faeser has said she will attend the World Cup after being given a, quote, guarantee of safety, end quote, for LGBTQ fans by Qatar's prime minister. Faeser had previously said that Qatar's hosting of the World Cup was very tricky, quote, end quote, from Berlin's perspective, prompting Doha, the capital, to summon the German ambassador amid accusations of double standards and racism. FIFA, which awards the World Cup tournament different countries every 4 years, has stressed that all fans are welcome at the World Cup in Qatar, as has the Qatar Organizing Committee. the Emir and the Gulf state, Tamim bin Hamad Al Thani, has also said recently that for, quote, culture, for quote, our culture, end quote, is expected. So we'll just see where all that goes. Now, let's see what else is going on. This is happening in Canada. Evidently, India and Canada see a diplomatic rift over the Sikh Khalistan vote. The issue of Sikh separatist groups operating in Canada has become a growing source of tension between New Delhi and Ottawa. A Sikh separatist group organized a so-called referendum in the Canadian city of Brampton on Sunday, asking the Sikh diaspora in the North American country to vote on whether areas of India where the Sikh religion is in the majority, should be an independent country known as Khalistan or Khalistan. While the Sikhs for Justice, the SFJ, which has been outlawed in India as a terrorist organization, claims thousands of people took part in a vote, it was not clear how many exactly participated and when the results would be out. Videos on social media showed lines of men and women with yellow Khalistan flags turning up at a polling station, but their authenticity cannot be independently verified. Quote, there were people who came in cars and buses from outside Brampton. There was an arrangement for food and shelter for visiting people from around Canada. Entry to the venue was only possible for those who back the movement, said Himanshu Bharadwaj, a Brampton resident. Well, it's a warning to the Canadian government. India has strongly condemned the vote and the Canadian government for allowing it to take place. Last week, New Delhi issued a strongly worded statement calling on Prime Minister Justin Trudeau's administration to ban the groups behind the vote. Quote, we find it deeply objectionable that politically motivated exercises by extremist elements are allowed to take place in a friendly country, end quote. Arindam Bagchi, the spokesperson for India's foreign ministry, said last week, quote, our position on the efforts by anti-India elements to hold the so-called Khalistan referendum is well known and has been conveyed to the Canadian government, both in New Delhi and in Canada, Bagchi had said. While the Canadian government has said that it respects India's sovereignty and territorial integrity, it had refused to stop the vote. Quote, Canada has a longstanding position on this issue. There is no crime to prosecute here. Conservative and Liberal Party leaders are wary of it becoming a violation of the freedom of expression issue. So said Terry Maluski, a retired CBC, Canadian Broadcasting Corporation journalist and author of Blood for Blood, 50 Years of the Global Khalistan Project. Well, the Sikh political voice is growing in Canada. Khalistan is the name of the state some secessionist groups propose to set up by carving out areas of India where the Sikh religion is in the majority. The violent separatist movement began in the 1980s. Some Sikh separatist outfits have been increasing their presence and influence in places like Canada, the United Kingdom, and the United States, which have sizable Sikh diaspora. Sikhs currently account for around 1.4% of Canada's population, or about 500,000 people. They are becoming a key political constituency, with several Sikh lawmakers now serving in both the federal parliament as well as in local councils. Quote, Canadian leaders do not want to lose Sikh votes, but they wrongly think the loud majority, or rather loud minority of Khalistanis, are all Sikhs of Canada, Maluski had said. even if, say, 100,000 Sikhs turned up to vote, which is an exaggeration, that means about 80% of all Sikhs do not care for this cause. It looks like a public relations campaign, a money-making enterprise that brings good business for the party involved, he added. Ahead of the vote over the weekend, India had even been reminded by Ottawa of the 1985 bombing of Air India Flight 182 off the coast of Ireland that killed all 329 passengers and crew, including 268 Canadian citizens. Canada-based Sikh militants were responsible for the attack. It had been the world's deadliest act of air terrorism prior to the 9/11 attacks in the United States. New Delhi also issued a rare travel advisory against Canada, citing rising anti-India incidents after the first round of the vote, which took place in September. The issue of Sikh separatist groups operating in Canada has become a growing source of tension between New Delhi and Ottawa. Quote, this is a low-intensity issue for Canada as of now, but definitely an irritant between the two countries. A vote taking place on Canadian soil for a state in India is plain absurd, Malusky had stressed. Well, there are fears of Hindu-Sikh tension in Canada. The Indian government, meanwhile, has been cracking down on anyone suspected of having ties to the Khalistan movement. Quote, Unlawful Activities or Prevention Act, UAPA, a stringent law, has been used against some Sikh youth for waging war against the state. These men, all under the age of 30, have been sent to jail for, say, putting up posters of Khalistan referendums or for possessing material related to the secessionist movement, said R.S. Baines, a human rights lawyer defending such cases. The organizers sitting in foreign countries do not understand the serious damage to the lives of these men and to their families. They use brainwashed youth who are often paid money for these activities. Sadly, they languish in jails for years. These so-called referendums have also caused a divide between Sikhs and Hindus in Canada. The Hindu community might get incensed, and my fear is that while we live peacefully with Sikhs here, I feel the situation could get tense with these referendums and can spiral into conflict, said Bharadwaj, who migrated from India and is currently working in Brampton as an accounting professional. Quote, people around me are concerned about the growing distrust between our communities fueled by this politics. Some fear the growing tensions could lead to violence and rioting, similar to the recent violence between Hindus and Muslims that shocked the United Kingdom city of Leicester, which is home to a large community of South Asian origin. Diaspora brings identities from their old homes to new ones. State narratives affect them. They often bring overseas the polarized politics of home, says Ajay Bisaria, a former Indian envoy to Canada. Quote, connections with homeland have also got stronger with mobility, technology, and social media. You don't have the benefit of borders in Brampton or Leicester to prevent conflict, and we see that diasporas are weaponized by state agencies of Pakistan to raise protest banners on Kashmir or Khalistani flags or other anti-India issues, he added. So, unbelievable. And so it goes. It's going to be... It's just going to be very, very interesting. What can I tell you? This is going to be very, very interesting as well. More conflict around the world. Will China's emboldened Xi Jinping take a gamble on Taiwan? It seems that China's leader holds more power than ever before. Beijing denies having an accelerated timeline on Taiwan reunification, quote-unquote. defense analysts say that military preparation has been ongoing for years. The Chinese Communist Party, the CCP Congress, which concluded late last month, has put Chinese leader Xi Jinping at the peak of his power, with political opponents swept aside and Xi's governing doctrine at the core of the Chinese Communist Party policymaking. During Xi Jinping's 10 years in power, Beijing has taken an aggressive stance on reunifying, quote-unquote, Taiwan with mainland China. The Chinese Communist Party considers the democratic self-ruled island as part of China's territory. At the Congress, the Chinese Communist Party enshrined its inter-party doctrine, a statement, quote, resolutely opposing and deterring separatists seeking Taiwan independence, quote unquote. And Xi also reiterated his goal of achieving peaceful unification with Taiwan, with the use of force remaining an option to achieve the task if necessary. Question is Beijing speeding up the Taiwan timetable? Xi talked about firm resolve and strong capabilities to oppose Taiwan's independence, but he didn't talk about intent, plan, or timetable, said Wen Ti-sung, a lecturer in Taiwan studies at the Australian National University. Wen asked added that what Xi intends to make the timetable and urgency of his plans for Taiwan ambiguous, quote unquote. However, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken said late last month that a decision has already been made in Beijing to, quote, speed up reunification, end quote. U.S. Navy officer Admiral Michael Gilday told a think tank event last month that it is impossible to rule out a Chinese invasion of Taiwan in the near future. I don't mean at all to be alarmist by saying that. It's just that we can't wish that away, Gilday told the Atlantic Council. In a speech to the Institute for China-America Studies last week, Chinese diplomat Jin Kuan said that Beijing has no timetable for achieving unification with Taiwan, adding that the Chinese government doesn't want to, quote, use force against the island, end quote, but needs to have the capability to deter Taipei from declaring independence. So an issue will be using force if necessary. Part of this deterrence, quote unquote, includes a military buildup of the People's Liberation Army, the PLA, along with regular air sorties over the Taiwan Strait, including massive coordinated military exercises around the island in August. Despite the rhetoric of a peaceful reunification, Beijing moves in recent years have made working with Taipei on building ties towards, quote, one China, end quote, politically unfeasible. Quote, there's almost no prospect for peaceful, politically driven unification between China and Taiwan as it now stands because Beijing is completely unwilling to adopt a different approach that takes into account the interest of the people of Taiwan, said Drew Thompson, a visiting senior research fellow at the National University of Singapore. One proposal from Beijing on Taiwan has been the so-called, quote, one country, two systems model used in Hong Kong, with which Chinese sovereignty is recognized, but semi-autonomous aspects of local governance are kept in place. However, China's crackdown on civil liberties and democratic institutions in Hong Kong over the past several years have shattered any illusion in Taiwan about accepting this model. One country, two systems is rejected by both major political parties in Taiwan, Thompson had said. That leaves China with the option of coercion, which Beijing has been imposing through economic, diplomatic, and military means. It's pursuing those with great vigor, said Thompson, who is also a former U.S. defense official covering China. There is no peaceful resolution on the table right now, And as a result, I think the likelihood and probability of a military conflict across the Taiwan Straits are heightened, he said. Analysts added that debates following the Chinese Communist Party Congress about a timeline on Beijing taking Taiwan are missing the point, as China has been modernizing its military with Taiwan in mind for over 20 years. First of all, most people focus on the actual decision, but military preparation for that decision, whether or not to launch an attack or invasion, takes years, if not decades, for preparation. China has been preparing for that eventuality, he said. Ivy Quek, a fellow for China at the International Crisis Group, said that Beijing continues to exhibit, quote, strategic patience, end quote, as it, quote, believes that time is on its side with regard to resolving the Taiwan question, end quote. At the same time, a more assertive Beijing will likely increase its pressure on Taipei, including ramping up military pressure or exerting greater economic coercion. Well, Quek also pointed out a confident declaration in the work report on Taiwan from the Congress saying, quote, the wheels of history are rolling on. Complete reunification of our country must be realized, and it can. Without a doubt, he realized. So it goes. Wow. It's amazing. You know, you see what's going on. It literally is amazing. New news about what's going on, a new update with regard to Ukraine. Ukraine has received the first NASAMS air defense systems. Ukraine's defense ministry said it received its first NASAMS, NASAMS, and ASPID air defense systems. Meanwhile, the Ukrainian government has taken over shares in five strategic companies. Ukrainian defense minister Oleksiy Reznikov said on Monday that the country had received its first NASAMS and APSID air defense systems. We will continue to shoot down the enemy targets attacking us. Thank you to our partners, Norway, Spain, and the United States, he wrote on Twitter. Well, Russia has hit Ukrainian infrastructure with a barrage of strikes over the past month that has destroyed around a third of the country's power stations, leaving many cities facing frequent blackouts. Ukraine hopes to use the advanced air defense systems to prevent further loss of infrastructure from Russian strikes. Reznikov said last month that Ukraine had received the first IRIS-T air defense system from Germany. The SAMS, or the National Advanced Surface-to-Air Missile System, is a short to medium-range ground-based air defense system by Norwegian company Kongsberg Defense and Aerospace, KDA, and American conglomerate Raytheon Technologies. ASPID is an Italian medium-range anti-aircraft missile system. So here are the other main headlines from the war in Ukraine on Monday. U.S. vows that Ukraine support even if Republicans win midterms. The White House said that U.S. support for Ukraine's war effort will be unwavering, quote unquote, even if Republicans who have expressed concerns about the level of spending win midterm elections. Quote, we are confident the United States support will be unflinching and will be unwavering, Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre told reporters. She said that President Joe Biden's, quote, is committed to a work in a bipartisan fashion, as he has been doing, to support Ukraine. However, the United States reserves the right to hold talks with Russia at the senior level on risk reduction, the White House said, in not denying a report that National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan has been talking to Moscow. Putin-linked businessman admits to interfering in the U.S. elections. Well, it seems that Yevgeny Prigozhin, an influential Russian businessman linked to President Vladimir Putin, admitted on Monday interfering in U.S. elections and said he would continue to do so. Quote, we have interfered are interfering and will continue to interfere carefully, precisely, surgically, and in our own way, end quote, Prigozhin said in remarks posted by his spokespeople on social media. Prigozhin, a dozen other Russian nationals, and three Russian companies were charged with operating a covert social media campaign aimed at fomenting discord and dividing American public opinion ahead of the 2016 U.S. presidential election. They were indicted in 2018 as part of special counsel Robert Mueller's investigation into Russian election interference. Prigozhin had denied involvement in election interference until now. He also previously denied ties to the Wagner mercenary group or force, but in September admitted to founding and financing it in 2014 and started speaking openly about its involvement in the war in Ukraine. For years, the Wagner group had been suspected of playing a role in realizing Moscow's overseas ambitions, with the Kremlin denying any links. Meanwhile, White House spokesperson Karine Jean-Pierre said Prigozhin's comments did not tell, quote, anything new or surprising, end quote. Well, Putin puts 50,000 newly mobilized Russians are fighting in Ukraine. That's what he says, rather, that 50,000 newly mobilized Russians are fighting in the Ukraine. Russian President Vladimir Putin said that 50,000 Russian soldiers called up as part of his mobilization drive were now fighting with combat units in Ukraine. Quote, we now have 50,000 in their combat units. The rest are not taking part in the fighting yet, Putin said during a visit to the Tver region outside Moscow. He also said that overall 80,000 newly mobilized Russians were, quote, in the zone of the special military operation, end quote, the term Russia uses for its war in Ukraine, while the rest of the draftees were at training camps in Russia. On November 4, Putin said a total of 318,000 had been drafted and 49,000 were in the combat zone. In September, Putin announced a, quote, partial mobilization drive to call up hundreds of thousands of new fighters for the war after Ukraine recaptured large swaths of territory in a counteroffensive. Russia ended the partial mobilization drive at the end of October, with Defense Minister Sergei Shoigu saying on October 28 that around 41,000 Russian fighters had already joined their combat units fighting in Ukraine. Well, Ukraine takes over shares in five strategic companies. Top Ukrainian officials said on Monday that the shares of five strategic companies have been taken over by the Defense Ministry under wartime laws. The decision was taken at a top security meeting on November 5 and came into force the following day, Security Council Secretary Oleksiy Danilov told a briefing. According to Danilov, after the end of the martial law, that assets can be returned to their owners on their or their value can be compensated accordingly. President Volodymyr Zelensky said that a move to take control of stakes in five strategic companies was needed to meet Ukraine's urgent wartime needs. Quote, such steps, which are necessary for our country in conditions of war, are carried out in accordance with current laws and will help meet the current needs of our defense sector, end quote, he wrote on the Telegram messaging app. The companies included aircraft engine maker Motozish, energy companies Urnafta and Uratnafta, vehicle maker Avtokaz, and transformer maker Zaporizhzhia Transformator. Well, the companies have links to prominent businessmen such as Ihor Kolomoisky or Kostyantin Zhivago. Some of them are already partially owned by the state. In October, Vyacheslav Boguslav, the president of Motozhich, was detained and charged with treason. Russian Marine unit says it lost 300 men in 4 days. Seemed a complaint from members of a Russian Marine Infantry Brigade published by a Telegram channel with links to the Wagner mercenary group, claimed that the brigade lost 300 soldiers within just 4 days of fighting in Donetsk. The soldiers had either been killed, wounded, or were missing, the complaint had said. The Russian governor of the occupied Donetsk region, Oleg Kozemyako, to whom the complaint was directed, rejected the high numbers published on Telegram, but admitted that there had been heavy losses. Well, the Finnish president says no end appears close in the Ukraine war. President Sauli Niinisto has said he sees no end in sight to the war in Ukraine, spurred by the conflict Helsinki is pushing to join the NATO military alliance. Niinisto warned that the longer the war dragged on, the greater the risks. However, he also said that Finland would maintain its support for Ukraine. There is no end in sight to the war, and neither side is compromising its initial positions, Niinisto had said. Finland will help Ukraine for as long as it takes. However, it's dangerous that talk about war is becoming commonplace. Finnish president also said there was no plan for his country to allow nuclear weapons on its soil and that there were no, quote, signs that anyone is offering them to the Finns, end quote. The country's prime minister, Sanna Marin, last week said she would not rule out the possibility of having nuclear weapons on Finnish territory. Well, the Ukraine grid operator warns of more power blackouts. Ukraine's national electricity grid operator has told consumers to brace for more blackouts in Kyiv and other territories or regions. Rolling blackouts are becoming increasingly common in the capital, Kyiv, after Russian missiles and drone attacks on energy infrastructure. Strikes targeting Ukraine's power facilities have damaged some 40% of energy infrastructure since October 10, and the operator said the repair efforts would take some time. The country's power grid still cannot resume full operation after the Russian terrorist attacks. In some regions, we have to introduce blackouts to avoid overloading the high-voltage infrastructure, the Ukrenergo grid operator had said. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky said late on Sunday that Russia might be preparing more airstrikes. Well, the UK says that Russia faces a struggle in the skies over Ukraine. United Kingdom Ministry of Defense said Russia is unlikely to be able to gain air superiority in Ukraine in the coming months. The assessment on Monday follows a statement last week in which Commander-in-Chief of the Armed Forces of Ukraine, Valery Zaluzhny, claimed Russia had lost more than twice as many aircraft in Ukraine than in the nine-year Soviet-Afghan War, 278 in Ukraine compared to 119 in Afghanistan. While the UK ministry said it could not independently verify the figures, it says that Russia's continued lack of air superiority was likely exacerbated by poor training and the loss of experienced crews. It also said that Russia faced a heightened risk of conducting close air support in densely covered air defense zones. So this is unlikely to change in the next few months, said the ministry. Russia's aircraft losses likely significantly outstripped their capacity to manufacture new airframes. The time required for the training of competent pilots and further reduces Russia's ability to regenerate combat air capability. And we'll conclude by this. More from about what's going on. Evidently, the Kyiv mayor, Vitaly Klitschko, has warned of power outages in the Ukrainian capital on Sunday. Meanwhile, Russian media claimed that Novohakovka dam was damaged in shelling by Ukrainian forces. Americans of Eastern European heritage tend to vote conservatively, but that could change, as Republicans have said they will reduce support for Ukraine if they win the midterm elections. Well, Ukrainians are scrambling to repair buildings damaged by Russia and villages in northern Ukraine that national forces liberated in the spring to see how reconstruction efforts are coming along. And it's a tough, it's really, really tough. So it's not working too well. Anyway, so that's the story for us today. Just not quite sure. This you might find interesting, last few minutes. In the World Cup 2022, there are high hopes for Senegal's golden generation. The Teranga Lions squad is full of talent, as it was in the 2002 World Cup, where they reached the last eight. Having won the Africa Club of Nations this year, can they reach the height of their predecessor in Qatar? So when Aliou Cisse walked into a press conference in Vienna in late September, the former defender headed straight towards this reporter, the only new face among a traveling group of media that followed the Senegalese national team on its final lap of preparation for the World Cup, and shook hands. The 46-year-old was captain of the Senegal team that reached the quarterfinals in their first appearance at the World Cup in 2002. Now in charge of the Teranga Lions, he wants to go even further with the reigning African champions. We know it is a huge task ahead of us, but we will try our best to make our people proud and our continent. Senegal has been drawn in Group A, where they will play against the Netherlands, host Qatar, and Ecuador. So Cisse has been allowed to build his side for the last 7 years. In that time, the team has garnered immense experience, won the African title, and narrowly missed out of qualifying for the second round at Russia in 2018 after collecting more yellow cards than Japan and missing out by virtue of fair play rules. Quote, going to this World Cup, we have ambitions, he said. But as I say, we must first take the matches one after the other. First, our objective is to get out of the group, and then we know that in knockout games of the last 16 and quarterfinals, we have enough experience to be able to really say our piece in the competition. His former teammate, El Hadji Diouf, believes that Cisse will make his mark. We can call Aliou coach, but he is a born leader, Diouf said of his former captain. We are all together behind this team for one thing, to make this team to be one of the best teams in the world. So I guess that's the story there. It'll be very, very interesting to see where all this goes. So let's hope for the best. Well, that's the end of our time today. I hope you enjoyed it, and we'll speak to you, let me see, tomorrow. I do not think we'll be doing a show tomorrow because I've got to go and engage in surgery. I'm not going to be engaging. I'll just be laying there, and the doctors will be doing a number on me. So we'll have to see where that goes. Let's hope that'll all work out fine. And but that's got to get done. So let me just see what else is we need to do. I think that's it here. So we'll say goodbye, and we thank you again for being with us today. Goodbye. Speak to you on Thursday.